Thank you. Thank you for having me, and you can never be too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Reuven Fenton, New York Post star reporter and author of the new book, Goyhood. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TwoJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TwoJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This is Memorial Day weekend, once a solemn and serious time for commemorating our war dead, but now, for most of us, just a good excuse to start the summer and head off to vacation. It's true that the actual observance of Memorial Day has declined to the point that it seems to represent not much more than the weekend when we start holding barbecues and pool parties or head off to cool weather places. Arizonans are fond of San Diego, of course, but that's a shame. For remembering our honored dead is a moral responsibility, and it has great resonance in Jewish tradition. It's an important question, really. How do we go about remembering those we've lost, who have honored us and our society, often by their sacrifice? The ways in which we remember them says a lot about us as a people. Memorial Day is an American traditional holiday of a sort, although perhaps not as old a tradition as you might think. The American Memorial Day began in New York State about a year after the end of the Civil War in 1866, when communities began to observe something called Decoration Day, decorating the graves of the dead of that terrible conflict. Within a couple of years, the observance had become national, a sign of the broad sense of loss that the brutal American Civil War created. It was widely observed, but in different ways in the North and South, as you might expect. In those days, Memorial Day was observed on May 30th, and that remained true until 1970. But in 1968, Congress passed a law to take effect in a few years, changing the observance of several holidays, Memorial Day and President's Day among them, to a Monday observance, creating these three-day weekends we enjoy, and thus a lot of appliance and furniture sales. Memorial Day only became an official national holiday in America in 1971, when it was fixed to the last Monday in May, where it remains. Now, the concept of having a specific time to remember and honor the dead, well, that's an idea that's particularly significant for Jews and Judaism. And it has been so for many hundreds of years. Four times a year, we Jews observe a special service called Yizkor, Remembrance, which allows all of us who have lost loved ones to gather together and remember their lives and their meaning to us personally. These Yizkor prayers are held on the holidays of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and Shmini Atzeret at the end of Sukkot in the autumn, and on Passover and Shavuot in the spring. Yizkor dates back at least 1,000 years, perhaps much more. Some people attend synagogue only on the holy days when Yizkor is included, as a way to honor their ancestors and all the relatives they have lost. In addition, there are two other Jewish versions of Memorial Day that are more contemporary editions of this commemoration: Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, both falling in the late spring. You could say that Jews have a certain affinity for the somber observance of Memorial Days, perhaps because we have so often lost people under tragic circumstances throughout our history. This year, Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, was particularly painful, with the memory of the murder of over 1,200 people by Palestinian terrorists last October 7th, and the further loss of close to 300 soldiers in the war against the Hamas terrorists in Gaza and the Hezbollah terrorists in the north. It's a sharp reminder of the high price that Israeli Jews pay and will continue to pay for their independent, free, democratic nation. Now, I do understand that a three-day weekend is a good time to have a pool party and barbecue or even shop the Memorial Day sales, but it's important to recall that our own freedom required great sacrifice from many people, and to honor that sacrifice meaningfully. And so, to play us in this morning, here is a classic song about friends who served with us and are gone. The words are by the great Israeli poet Chaim Guri, written after the War of Independence, the Milchemet Shichrur, in a modern recording by Harel Scott. The poem is about Israel's military dead, but the sentiment is universal. They are gone from our midst, all their laughter, their youth, and their splendor. But we know that a friendship like that we are bound all our lives to remember. For a love that in battle is forged will endure while we live, fierce and tender.
Al ha-negev yored lel ha-stav U-matzit kochavim cheresh-cheresh Et ha-ruach over al ha-saf Ananim מהלכים על הדרך כבר שנה לא הרגשנו כמעט החלפו הזמנים בשדותינו כבר שנה ונותרנו מעט מרבים שאינם עוד בינינו אך נזכור את כולם, את יפי הבלורית והתואר, כי ראות שכזאת לעולם לא תיתן את ליבנו לשכוח אהבה מקודשת בדם. מקודשת בדם, אתה שוב
That was Harayut, Chaim Guri's great poem, The Friend, as sung by Harel Scott. We hope that in future, those friendships don't have to be forged in battle as they are being forged today. On this Memorial Day weekend, we should all take a few moments to remember the debt we owe to those who died protecting our own country, America. And we Jews should also remember those who died protecting Israel. We should appreciate the freedom we enjoy, including the precious freedom of conscience that America allows us to practice our own religion fully and openly. May it continue always to be so. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, New York Post star reporter Reuven Fenton, author of gripping nonfiction books, tells us what prompted him to write his first novel, Goyhood. Find out when we come back in just a moment here on To Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Reuven Fenton is a prominent reporter who has been covering all kinds of murders and scandals for the New York Post since 2007. His new book, his first novel, is called Goyhood. It's fascinating, and it's kind of a wild book. Good morning, and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
So the idea for this book came from a real live court hearing. Tell us about that a little bit. Or maybe that was, that was for Stolen Years, an earlier book.
Right, it seems like a lifetime ago now. My new one is Goyhood, this novel about an Orthodox Jew that discovers in middle age he's not actually Jewish, and his whole life falls apart, basically, upon this realization, and he ends up taking to the road with his estranged twin brother on a wild journey through the deep south.
It's a real picaresque novel. It's kind of a crazy story. I know I called it that more than once, but is this based in anything in your reportage, or is it just kind of out of your head?
You know, it was out of my head, but it's personal. It was out of my head in the sense that I'm always coming up with what if ideas that just pop into my head sometimes, and I'll write them down in the case I ever want to use them. Of course, you know, writing a novel takes a long time. So, you know, I don't know how many ideas I'm going to be able to use over my lifetime. But at any rate, I mean, you know, I being a Jew, with a whole kind of Jewish story of my own, I mean, you know, this felt particularly personal to me, which is why I pursued it versus, you know, any number of the other ideas I have. I was just, you know, very, very, you know, fascinated by the concept of, you know, somebody who is Orthodox, you know, is an Orthodox Jew, who, you know, truly letter of the law, who, you know, when he prays, with a full kind of confidence in himself that he's praying as a Jew, he's communicating with God as a Jew, only to discover that, you know, this has all been kind of a fallacy. I mean, and coming to terms with the existential angst of that whole thing really, really intrigued me.
You yourself went to Yeshiva University, kind of impeccably Jewish credentials, right? So how did you explore this idea of kind of lost identity?
It has a lot to do, I think, with my upbringing, and that, you know, I grew up in a traditionally Jewish family, but we weren't, you know, we weren't Orthodox, we weren't terribly observant.
You were born in Cincinnati, if I'm not mistaken.
I was born in Cincinnati, and then I grew up, we moved when I was young to the town of Lexington, Massachusetts, which is outside of Boston by about a 20-minute drive. And it was there that my parents discovered, they got in contact with a rabbi who ran a Chabad synagogue in our town. And there ended up being a fairly abrupt transformation of sorts. When I was around the age of 11 or 12, my parents got heavily involved in Judaism, and we essentially became Orthodox very quickly, to put it in simple terms. And that created this sort of a dichotomy in me, in the sense of, you know, I was still, you know, missing the secular life. I was a child sort of torn between this kind of religious and secular world. And all of a sudden, you know, and that created this conflict in me, which I think is represented by the novel in certain ways, particularly its two protagonists, one of whom is deeply Orthodox, and one of them is, his twin brother is kind of a hedonist, if you will.
Right.
And I think this sort of, these two brothers represent a certain division inside me that, you know, I think I struggle with to this very day.
We will talk much more with Reuven Fenton. His new book is called Goyhood. It's a fascinating book. When we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. with an Oneg Shabbat afterwards. Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat morning services, always followed by a Kiddush. You can find out more about our services at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and all guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age children or grandchildren starting for the 57-85 school year in the sixth year of our outstanding youth education program. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come Friday night, either in person at 6:30 p.m. or on our Facebook page at the same time on Facebook Live. The Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. and services are at 10 a.m. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. My friends, if you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating. Review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Israel is obviously engaged in a serious war in Gaza. America is extremely close ally of Israel and sees Israel as a close ally of America. What are the tools that a close ally can use to influence another, and when is it successful doing so, and when is it not so successful?
Well, in this case, we've obviously been completely unsuccessful. And, you know, I never want to talk about Israeli politics,
never.
And I won't today either.
Okay.
But I'm happy to talk about American politics and the American diplomatic establishment. And I will say that we have sent some really stellar leaders of our foreign policy establishment in the person of the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, the Director of the CIA, Bill Burns, brilliant guy, repeatedly to the region to try to nudge the process forward of negotiating a ceasefire, a hostage release.
Hostages.
I mean, there's a clear set of goals, and also to talk about the day after.
Day after, yeah.
And some Israelis will engage, but the prime minister who calls the shots won't. And so what tools does America have left when the prime minister refuses to engage with high-level emissaries and with serious negotiators? And, you know, it comes down to a couple of things which are almost unthinkable, but they're becoming less unthinkable. And those things are reducing or eliminating any form of aid to Israel, any kind of economic assistance, reducing or eliminating completely any kinds of arms sales or arms supplies, reducing or eliminating completely any kind of intelligence sharing. We actually have a lot of tools in our arsenal that normally would never be considered in
right.
dealing with a close ally like Israel.
Yeah, of course.
But at the moment, I think there's a lot of frustration in Washington and a lot of sense that they have like an immovable object in the person of the Israeli prime minister. So, you know, at some point, somebody's going to bang their head through a window and there's going to be a dramatic shift in the current landscape. The current landscape cannot continue forever.
Now, it's challenging when an ally is so close and it has significant support on both sides of the aisle, as we say in America. This would be true for Israel, but it'd be true for some other countries as well. It's difficult to pull tools out, as you describe them, that seem maybe more effective, but also more punitive, right? Doesn't that limit you if you're in charge?
Doesn't it limit who?
Doesn't it limit even the President of the United States, who theoretically has control over foreign policy to a large degree, when he knows that any decision he makes is going to be second-guessed by a very closely divided governmental structure?
In an election year.
In an election year, yeah, especially.
Right. So that complicates
everything,
making good, clear-headed policy decisions. Yeah, I mean, there's always a lot of constraints on American leadership. This situation is unprecedented. Even Golda, as tough as she was, heard pleas and read messages very well. That just doesn't seem to be the case in the current situation. Inadvertently, Israel may hand Hamas a victory and may force U.S. leadership to take positions it would never have considered in the past.
You know, I've always felt, and I don't want to go too much deeper into this, but, you know, this has been a hard situation from the beginning, and it's not getting any easier. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The Israeli ambassador at the UN is speaking about negotiations with the Palestinians. Ladies and gentlemen, before I commence my speech, I want to relay an old Jewish Passover story to all of you. When Moses led the Jews out of Egypt towards the Promised Land, he had to go through the nearly endless Sinai Desert. When they finally reached the Promised Land, the people were very thirsty. They needed water. Moses struck the side of a mountain with his staff, and a pond appeared with crystal, cool, clean water. The people rejoiced and drank to their heart's content. Moses wished to cleanse his body, so he went over to the other side of the pond, took all his clothes off, and dove into the cool water. When Moses came out of the water, however, he discovered his clothes had all been stolen and said, "Moses, I have reason to believe the Palestinians stole my clothes." A Palestinian delegate to the UN, hearing this accusation, jumps from his seat and screams out, "What a travesty. It's widely known there were no Palestinians there at that time." "Ah," says the Israeli ambassador, "now we are ready to negotiate." That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature of Too Jewish, Just For You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we complete the reading of the book of Leviticus with the Torah portion known as Bechukotai. At the completion of a book of Torah that is focused on holiness and rituals of sanctification and celebration, we conclude this exploration with a statement of covenant. God says here, "If you keep these, my laws of holiness, you will long flourish in the land I will give you." It's a promise based on action. If we choose to live lives dedicated to holiness, our actions will bring blessings. We have the capacity to create a world with meaning and goodness. But holiness is a bit of a strange idea. In Judaism, holiness is usually something we create, rather than something given to us from above or outside. A little example to demonstrate how we create holiness. Now, a sheepskin is not a holy object, right? Where I'm from originally in Southern California, you use them to cover your car seats if you have a convertible. Nothing holy about that sheepskin. So what happens if you take the sheepskin, remove the hair, and cure it into parchment? Is it holy now? No, it's just a piece of parchment, a paper. But if you take that parchment and you give it to a scribe, a sofer, who writes on it a section of the text of Torah, and if that piece of parchment is then sewn together with other texts like that, and if the whole parchment is wrapped around Atzei Chaim, wooden poles, and if it's dedicated and carried around a synagogue and chanted from publicly and blessings said over it, and it's used for bar and bat mitzvahs and touched and kissed with the fringes of a tallit, well, that piece of parchment has become something more than it was originally. It has become holy through our own actions. We've taken a common object, a sheepskin we could have used for any number of uses, and created out of it an object that is sacred. The lesson of Leviticus is that we have a similar capacity to make our own ordinary lives holy. We can lead lives that are regular and prosaic, or we can make the choice to live truly holy lives. That choice is, in fact, an ethical one. We make that choice every day, sometimes every hour, when we decide how we are going to act. When we give freely of ourselves, as Leviticus asks us to do, we increase holiness in the world. Perhaps even more importantly, by doing so, we give our lives meaning, beauty, and sanctity. May we always make that choice. When we come back in a moment, our guest, Reuven Fenton, who has covered many serious stories as a reporter and nonfiction author, tries his hand at fiction in his new picaresque novel, Goyhood. It's a great read indeed. Find out all about it when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu.
three European Union countries are poised to recognize the imaginary state of Palestine as a reaction against the Israel-Gaza war. Spain, Norway, and Ireland said last week that they would formally recognize a Palestinian state, yet another of Israel's challenges on the global stage. The countries portrayed the step as an attempt to salvage long-dormant prospects for progress towards a two-state solution, creating a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Israel castigated the move as a reward for Hamas's October 7th Palestinian terrorist attack, which launched the current war with its brutal atrocities committed by Hamas 8 months ago. Last month, I stood on these same steps with Prime Minister Sanchez of Spain, and we said that the point of recognizing the state of Palestine was coming closer, Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris said in Dublin last week. That point has now arrived. The three countries' coordinated announcements underscore the degree to which the international community has lost patience with Israel amid its war against Hamas in Gaza. Recognition of a Palestinian state is a symbolic step with no immediate impact for Palestinians in Gaza or the West Bank. But it represents a rebuke to Israel, whose current government opposes Palestinian statehood, and which has long held a diplomatic resolution to the conflict should come only via direct negotiations. Israel swiftly condemned the announcements and recalled its ambassadors from Ireland and Norway immediately. Today's decision sends a message to the Palestinians and the world. Terrorism pays, said Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz. Although about 140 countries already recognize the fictitious nation of Palestine as a sovereign state, most Western European countries have avoided the move till now. Harris, the Prime Minister of Ireland, said he was confident more countries will recognize Palestine in the coming weeks. That rewards Hamas's Palestinian terrorists for war crimes, including rape, torture, kidnapping, arson, the murder of children and the elderly, and using children as human shields. Ireland has long been anti-Israel. It identifies with the Palestinian terrorists, perhaps because of its own long history of IRA terrorism. In the U.S., more than 60 Jewish organizations across the political spectrum are lining up behind a bill establishing a coordinator of government efforts to fight anti-Semitism. The joint effort is an expression of American Jewish political solidarity that has not been seen in many years. Groups signing the letter supporting the bill range from J Street to the Zionist Organization of America. The signatories include organizations whose leaders rarely share the same stage and who have accused each other at times of enabling anti-Semitism. They include Reconstructionist, Reform, Conservative, Modern Orthodox, and Haredi ultra-Orthodox groups. The letter sent last week to House Speaker Mike Johnson and Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries acknowledges the ideological range of the signatories, saying they are united in our deep concern over the exponentially rising incidence of anti-Semitism in this country. Quoted statistics from the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, and the American Jewish Committee documenting a sharp spike in anti-Semitism and Jewish concern about it since the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war October 7th. As you know, our community is currently facing a historic crisis of anti-Semitism not seen in a generation, the letter said. This historic rise in anti-Semitism is being directly felt by Jews all around the country. The letter was spearheaded by the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the JCPA, along with the ADL, the Reform Movement's Religious Action Center, the American Jewish Committee, and the National Council of Jewish Women. Such wall-to-wall Jewish organizational unity has not been expressed publicly since, maybe the George W. Bush administration. The bill, called the Countering Anti-Semitism Act, is sponsored by North Carolina Representative Kathy Manning. It has bipartisan support. It would create a national coordinator to oversee the implementation of the Biden administration's strategy to combat anti-Semitism. The coordinator would also receive an annual assessment of violent anti-Semitism across the country from law enforcement and intelligence agencies. The position would complement the State Department's anti-Semitism envoy, Deborah Lipstadt, currently, who focuses on monitoring and combating anti-Jewish bigotry abroad. The bill would also designate an official in the U.S. Department of Education to monitor anti-Semitism on campus, much needed.
The letter from the Jewish groups also says the bill would promote Holocaust education, help us understand the threat of anti-Semitic violent extremism, as well as the spread of anti-Semitism online, and celebrate Jewish life by designating Jewish American Heritage Month in law, and more. The House passed a separate bill this month, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, defining anti-Semitism for the purpose of applying it in civil rights cases brought against educational institutions. That bill, however, received a surprising amount of opposition in the House and is facing resistance in the U.S. Senate. The prospects of a Senate defeat may help spur backing for Manning's bill, especially given the overwhelming Jewish support in the letter. At the heart of the fighting over the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, on the left and right, is that it adheres to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's widely adopted definition of anti-Semitism. Progressive Democrats who oppose the bill say the IRHA definition could chill and limit legitimate criticism of Israel. Conservatives on the right who endorse the charge that Jews killed Jesus, which has been disavowed by large Christian denominations and all sane human beings, say that it renders that claim anti-Semitic, which it is. Manning's bill finesses those divisions by politely nodding to the IHRA definition as useful and then citing as its basis a far more concise and uncontroversial definition of anti-Semitism that appeared in a 2020 Holocaust education law. Finally, pro-Palestinian terrorist encampment protesters at dozens of universities have been calling for months for their administrations to divest from Israeli companies. But on two campuses, activists are asking their schools to split from organizations that they are say are complicit in Israeli actions. Those organizations are Hillel and Chabad. At Drexel University in Philadelphia and the University of California, Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, pro-Palestinian terrorist protesters have demanded their universities cut ties with or terminate the presence of the school's Hillel chapters. The Drexel protesters also demanded that the university immediately terminate Drexel Chabad, an outpost, of course, of the Hasidic outreach movement of Lubavitch. The protesters include some Jewish students. They argue that Hillel's Zionist stance and the fact that its umbrella organization received funding from the Israeli government make it complicit in what they insanely call Israel's genocide in the Gaza Strip. Hillel receives millions from organizations financed by the Israeli apartheid state whose existence is reliant on Palestinian death. Jews Against White Supremacy, UC Santa Cruz, an anti-Zionist student collective supporting the Santa Cruz encampment, wrote earlier this month. Meanwhile, the Drexel Palestine Coalition urged its school to immediately terminate Drexel's chapter of Hillel, describing it as a global Zionist campus organization whose primary purpose, funding, and operations are to facilitate birthright trips to occupied Palestine. Swell. Go ahead, dig in on anti-Semitic conspiracy theories while you are at it. Why not? I'm surprised they did not cite the protocols of the Elders of Zion to prove Hillel helps college students control the international financial system and the media. The pro-Palestinian terrorist demands have led to bipartisan condemnation. Major Jewish groups cite them as evidence of the encampment movement's anti-Semitism. Calling for a complete boycott and to cut ties with Hillel, Center of Jewish Life on most campuses is anti-Semitic and ridiculous, said Amy Spitalnik, CEO of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. Look, the anti-Israel activity on campus started the day after October 7th. It wasn't the result of the deaths of Palestinians in Gaza. It was the result of carefully organized pro-terrorist groups funded by Qatar and Iran all across North America, many of them cheering the horrific Islamist ultra-violence of Hamas Palestinian terrorists, so long as that violence was aimed at Jews. If you think this is a spontaneous response to the war, you are being naive. I am no fan of Bibi Netanyahu or the way he has failed to prioritize freeing the surviving Israeli hostages during this war. As prime minister for many years, he has the responsibility for the cataclysmic disaster of October 7th on his hands. It was his watch. He has never accepted responsibility, nor has he yet had the courage to meet with the families of the murdered Israelis or the remaining hostages. But you can view Netanyahu as a failed leader lacking the decency to accept responsibility, as I do, and also recognize virulent, cultivated anti-Semitism when you see it. That's what the encampment movement is: professional, curated, organized anti-Semitism, cleverly located on college campuses to attract unsophisticated adolescents and some muddle-headed instructors. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Its basis for existence is the belief that only Jews don't have the right to a homeland, not to mention one that was ours for millennia. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Reuven Fenton, is a prominent reporter on all kinds of stuff for the New York Post. His first novel is called Goyhood, a dramatic story about a guy, as we said earlier in the show, who discovers that his rock-solid Orthodox Judaism is based on a lie. His mother wasn't Jewish. You set up this sort of parameter like he has a certain period of time, I guess like a week before he can do the conversion or something. That gave you time to send him off on quite a journey.
Indeed. It's interesting because on a practical level, this actually has happened to people before. And it's an unusual occurrence, but it does happen. And when it happens, the solution, if you choose to keep it simple, you could technically convert pretty quickly. And pretty easily and essentially forget that this whole thing ever happened. But, you know, because I wanted to explore this idea, I had to kind of create a situation, a scenario in which he needed the time to wrap his head. He didn't want to wrap his head around it. He actually wanted to take the quick route back to his old life. But circumstances which I create in the story create this obstacle in which he's sort of forced to go on this road trip with his brother. And over the course of this trip, he's kind of forced to open his eyes to all sorts of realizations about himself and about his situation and about his relationship with his wife and all kinds of the truths about his life that he'd been conveniently ignoring for a quarter of a century. All of a sudden, you know, he's having to kind of face these understandings about himself because of this span of time I created for him to give him the space to explore these things.
So the twin brother, is that based on anybody?
It's not. I did actually kind of envision kind of a Jacob and Esau.
Yeah, it's a Yaakov and Esau sort of, right.
And I actually threw a couple of allusions in there, which are really for the Bible fans, a few Easter eggs, like biblical Easter
eggs. Okay, Easter eggs for the Jewish Bible fans. I don't know. There's that fits the book, but it's quite a contrast.
That sort of, I meant to allude to this Jacob and Esau dichotomy here. But it wasn't based on anyone personal, although I mentioned, these twin brothers do represent a dichotomy in me, and I do believe that they are both based on me on some level. That's in the sense that I do have these dueling forces inside me, this, you know, this God-fearing religious part of me, and then there's also I don't want to say hedonistic, but certainly a secular adventurous side, let's call it that.
In wandering around the South, I actually was a rabbi, and in the interest of full disclosure, I was a rabbi in South Carolina for 4 years, so I know a little bit about Judaism in the South. This is true, but kind of imagined Deep South. How did you put that together?
You know, I've been to all those states that are mentioned in the book, although I have no, you know, experience with the Jewish life there, which is kind of spanned, you know, mainly in the cities of the South, but in states like Alabama, Mississippi, there's very little of that going on. But, you know, in researching it, I mean, why I chose the South, I can't say. I think that was just sort of the magic of the creative process. But once I had decided on the South and on my story, there involved a lot of research. So, for example, you know, I'm like, well, where are they going? So I start looking at maps, and I'm following a road map to see, like, well, where are they headed? And when does evening fall on their journey? So where do they end up in the evening where they have to stay overnight somewhere? I mean, the whole book takes course pretty much over the course of 3 days. So as I'm mapping out their journey through the South, I'm looking at the towns they're driving through and the landscapes they're seeing and all the things they're seeing. And as I'm doing that, I'm kind of creating this, you know, a lot of people sort of describe, writing a novel as mapping out a completely dark cave with just a single candle. And in a sense, I was mapping this out as I went along, following their adventure. And when they'd arrive at some place, that's when I'd kind of, you know, research and to figure out what's going on here.
How did you come up with the character of Charlene?
The quick answer is that, again, it's like just the magic of the creative process, in the sense of like, okay, you know, they're in New Orleans. Well, what happened? You know, she appears in the New Orleans segment of the story. In the New Orleans segment of the story, what happens now? I mean, somehow I was taken by the idea of them picking up passengers as they go along. And as you, it's not a spoiler to say that one of their passengers is a dog.
As a dog, yeah, Popeye, right.
And then there's the character of Charlene. Well, who is Charlene relative to my protagonist, who's this completely insular individual who's been living in a cave, essentially, for the past 20 years? Well, Charlene is the opposite of that. She's this social media influencer who's constantly traveling, constantly out in the world, and you know, basically professionally broadcasting herself to an audience of people who follow her, you know, on Instagram. I think, you know, in literature and, you know, in entertainment, I think a key part of that is the tension between characters, and this idea of opposites, you know, really struck me. And so I thought that'd be fun. And I thought it'd be fun that as they get to know each other, that actually they'd find out they have more in common than they realize.
This is kind of like a little, I don't know, it's not really Jack Kerouac on the Road or a Bildungsroman, or you refer to it as a Rumspringa, which is, I think, an Amish word. It's one of those picaresque, bounce around, some stuff's going to happen, but you're never sure what's coming next. You're used to writing nonfiction. You're used to writing not only books, but of course, articles all the time about stuff that's going on. That's a creative process too, but it's a very disciplined kind of creative process, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, not nonfiction, particularly news writing, particularly my kind of news writing, which is essentially the old fashioned newspaper style.
Right.
Is a very much a, it's a defined art. I almost wouldn't call it an art, although there's art to it. And this creativity to it, but the parameters are well drawn. I mean, if you take like a news writing class, you learn about the inverted pyramid, which is essentially how you write a news story. You start with the most important stuff on top, and you
work your way down,
your way down the story and to the less important stuff. So there actually is a method to this that's comparable, maybe to technical writing. You know, and that's why when you read news stories, despite the name being different bylines, depending on the story,
they kind of sound the same, don't they?
Yes, they do. Because there's a technique to it that's made for most easily digestible type of writing that you can do, because you know you're assuming that readers are really just going to skim your story unless they're enthralled. So you're keeping your readers' time in mind. That being said, I really made a tremendous effort to make the story move, and that really came from a new sensibility. This is not a abstract literary work, okay? I essentially set out to write a page turner, a beach read with some philosophy in it. You know, it's essentially, but it is that. It's essentially a beach read. I mean, it's an easy read, and that came from very much from my new sensibility.
I have to tell you, your author quotes are from a whole bunch of people who've been on Too Jewish before, so you come highly recommended that way, including people like Adam Langer and Jonathan Troper and Joshua Cohen, who are some of my favorite contemporary authors.
I'll take that as a good sign.
Although, as my friends you say, great minds whirl down the same drain, it might be.
That's also true.
He's discovering who he is for the first time, really, right?
Well, or the first time since he was a kid.
Or first time since he decided to embrace Orthodoxy, move into this profound Jewish life that maybe hasn't been so fulfilling.
Yeah, but he hasn't needed to be fulfilled because he's chosen a certain life that is so encapsulated. It's so much inside a bubble that I mentioned early on in the story, you know, he lives in this little sliver of a neighborhood in Brooklyn called Kensington, which is maybe a quarter of a square mile. And he realizes as he's leaving the neighborhood to go to his mother's funeral, he's like, right. Wait a minute, I haven't left this neighborhood in 4 years, he realizes. He actually hasn't left the neighborhood in 4 years. He's been in a situation where, and I allude to that a lot. You know, he spends, you know, the entirety of his day in the study hall of a yeshiva.
Right, studying Talmud, right.
And I make a point to have the big giant, you know, it's called the base medrash, the big, yep. You know, the big study room has no windows. I do that intentionally because I want to emphasize the fact that his life is
interior.
It's a life of action, but of a very particular kind of action. That's the study of Torah.
You know, I noticed that detail because there's a Jewish, well, I think it's kind of halacha. There's kind of a Jewish law. It's certainly a tradition that a synagogue must have windows. And a Beit Midrash is a kind of synagogue. I mean, people do daven, they do pray there usually. I thought that was a unique detail and revealing in that aspect.
You know, it could well be. I mean, it would be interesting to me to know that because, you know, in the writing of this, I kind of took painstaking measures to get everything right.
Sure.
And to be, you know, not just authentic, but correct, you know, Jewishly correct. But inevitably, I may have gotten, you know, a little something wrong here and there. And I wonder if, in fact, it wouldn't be possible for this study hall to have no windows.
I think it could, although you're not technically, and of course, this is only technically because I'm sure there have been plenty of times in Jewish history where it was much safer to pray in a room with no windows. And the idea is you're always supposed to be somewhat connected to the community outside and to the outside world. Yeah.
But as you say, in dangerous times, maybe they did go to windowless places.
I think they did, or, you know, the famous, you know, the conversos who closed the shutters before they lit Shabbat candles or whatever. You know, it's definitely part of it. It's a terrific book. It's a fun read and surprising in so many ways. Have any of your Yeshiva University classmates commented on it?
Well, as far as Yeshiva University goes, I'm sort of detached from Yeshiva University at this point because I graduated a long time ago.
Sure.
But it's funny. Right now, I have people in all sorts of places reviewing it right now, and they're all people that I don't know. A surprisingly few amount of people who I do know have actually read it. Believe it or not, my mother still hasn't read it.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's not out yet. Although, you know, I could have gotten
sure.
like an advanced reader copy.
Sure.
I've been uneasy somehow about showing it to people. I think there's just something showing it to people that I know. I have no problem showing it to people I don't.
Right.
But somehow showing it to people I know, it's been awkward for me because, you know, a novel is such a personal thing. It's completely from my imagination, and if you're somewhat of a private person or introverted person, which I am somewhat, it's hard to show it to people. It really is.
Yeah. It's sort of like getting a little bit naked, if you will. You're showing something.
Totally like that. And I know I've got to get used to that, and I will. I'm on the verge of getting used to it. But it's been taking me a long time to really get at ease.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating because, you know, if you're writing nonfiction, well, you're hiding behind the facts, right? You're writing a byline. This is a story. I'm just covering it.
Totally different. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm essentially a scribe. I mean, yes, like if it's a nonfiction book, like I once did in the past, I wrote a nonfiction book and it had a lot of my creative touch to it, which I was somewhat, you know, sort of self-conscious about. But completely different because I'm telling stories about other people.
It's not your story. Yeah, absolutely. Riven, where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about Goyhood?
I would say the easiest route to find out anything is just to Google it. If you Google, you know, Riven Fenton Goyhood, you're going to see not just the Amazon page, but you're going to see my book profile on the Simon & Schuster website. They're the distributor, and it'll have my picture, my biography, my summary of the book and all of the blurbs from the various authors who blurbed it and a lot of information like that. But, you know, your best bet is Google. You'll find my Goodreads page with the reviews that are already on it. I think I got about 13 or 14 reviews so far. You know, hopefully many, many more to come. I mean, these are just advanced copy reviews and it's a little early. But that being said, Google and you'll see a wealth of material appear before your eyes about where you can buy it and where you can read about it.
And the book is out May 28th, which is coming up quickly. Thank you so much. And we look forward to the success of this book. And where you go next?
In terms of
what you write next, not necessarily if you're going home or going
Well, in terms of future projects, I'm loath to ever say, to ever give specifics, but I will say I've got what I'm calling a rickety first draft of a brand new novel. I will remain diligent with it until it's complete, and hopefully, it'll be two and many more novels.
Many more to come. As we say in my business, God willing. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be the best-selling and award-winning author of the new book, The Year of Living Constitutionally, the terrific A.J. Jacobs. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from the Koshauer Klezmer Band, and it's fun. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good and meaningful Memorial Day weekend, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.